From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're watching comings and goings at Trump Tower in New York today. We'll have the latest news on the Trump transition team in just a moment.
But first, to the concerns of the LGBT community about Trump. On 60 Minutes over the weekend, Trump said that as far as gay marriage goes, his feelings are irrelevant.
These cases have gone to the Supreme Court. They've been settled. And I'm fine with that.
But Dominic Holden, national LGBT reporter for BuzzFeed, says marriage is just one issue of importance to LGBT people that Trump could have an impact on. Dominic joins us now from Washington. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And you've said that many LGBT people have been freaking out, that's a quote, about Donald Trump. What are the main concerns, things that he might actually do as president?
Well, on election night, there was a lot of concern that he would revoke marriage rights for people, and people were wondering if they should book their florist or send out invitations before he takes office in January. He cannot do that on his own. The Supreme Court would ultimately have to decide. But it's important to note that while Trump says that that is settled law, he has also said that he would appoint Supreme Court justices who would overturn the marriage ruling from 2015. So that is something that could possibly happen down the line. So they're legitimate fears, but they're not nearly as urgent.
What about the things that he could do right now on his own?
So one of the big things that the Trump campaign has said is that they want to overturn Obama's executive actions. And he really pushed the envelope, particularly during his second term, as far as what presidential authority would allow him to do in terms of executive orders and guidance and regulations. One of the biggest was an order that expanded the protections for federal workers. It said that you could not discriminate against federal workers on the basis of gender identity, if they're transgender. In addition, he expanded that to say that you could not discriminate against federal contractors. Those contractors cannot make hiring or employment decisions based on sexual orientation or gender identity, protecting all of those employees through federal contractors. In addition, and I should say, Donald Trump could walk in on his first day in office and simply sign an executive order that negates those rights. And there are people in his campaign who have said that they intend to come in and revoke a number of executive orders and essentially erase the Obama presidency. So that's number one. The other thing that has caught people's attention a lot, particularly in the last year, is guidance that has been issued by the Department of Justice and by the Education Department that says that transgender students must be given access to accommodations that match their gender identity, just like other students of the same gender identity. In practical terms, this means that a transgender girl would be allowed to use the girls' restroom or the girls' locker room, play on girls' athletics teams. And this has caused a number of states to become upset. They have actually sued the federal government to overturn those rules.
Right.
The Justice Department has said that it's going to appeal that case, and it is going to try to maintain that guidance. And the Trump administration, with a new attorney general, could simply stop trying to fight those states and could acquiesce. In addition, they could find not only that they want to repeal this guidance protecting transgender students, they could instead make an alternative interpretation of the law. Hmm. What the Obama administration did is they said that bans on sex discrimination in education also ban transgender discrimination.
Well Dominic, let me ask you about
Let me just finish this really quickly to say that the Trump administration could actually say that these bans on sex discrimination do not apply to transgender people and that they do not have protection under those civil rights laws.
What about the military? Could he overturn the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Right. So in 2011, Congress repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and that thereby opened the door for gays and lesbians and bisexuals to serve openly in the military. And then that was followed up in 2015 with an order from Ash Carter saying that there's no discrimination in the military on the basis of sexual orientation. And then he allowed transgender people to serve openly. despite all of that, there's nothing that prevents the new commander-in-chief from taking a new stance and passing new orders or taking the position that you cannot serve as a gay person in the military, or he could simply say that the transgender accommodations in the military that have been made recently need to stop in their tracks, be not completed all the way, or completely reversed.
That's Dominic Holden, national LGBT reporter for BuzzFeed. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, New York's Democratic Mayor Bill de Blasio held a press conference outside Trump Tower today, shortly after what he called a candid meeting with President-elect Donald Trump. De Blasio said he told Trump of concerns he was hearing from New Yorkers about what a President Trump might do.
I talked to him about our Muslim community. I let him know something that so many people don't know, that there are 900 Muslim members of the NYPD protecting all of us. Protecting every community, every kind of person.
Well, the world awaits what a Trump administration might do. The New York Times led their report this morning with the revelation that international allies are having trouble reaching the soon-to-be president. World leaders are blindly calling Trump Tower in an effort to talk to him. Trump responded on Twitter that the New York Times is totally wrong and that the paper is just upset they look like fools in their coverage of me. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hi there.
And the New York Times story does paint a completely chaotic picture of the transition team, but so do other outlets. You know, Trump insiders are using words like bloodletting and knife fight. The conservative Republican Elliot Cohen, who said he was set to advise the Trump transition team, then tweeted, "Stay away, it's going to get ugly." Your thoughts about what's true, what's really going on?
Well, the Trump campaign had been something, and the Trump organization had been something, where Donald Trump likes to keep these political power centers at odds with each other. He likes powerful people within his organization all directly reporting to him. And when one gets too powerful, he can cut it off. Or when those two competing factions are fighting with each other, then he can weigh in and make the decision. So I think this is a way that you'll see Donald Trump govern. He's going to want competing factions. He's going to want this kind of drama to play out so that he feels he can make that kind of decision. It's also a way to consolidate power. When you have powerful people beneath you arguing with each other or bringing up different ideas, then you can make the decision about what to do next, and it winds up being all about you.
Well, but you know, it might be, as you say, by design to create this situation. But then you have things like, we know that Chris Christie was fired as the head of the transition team last week. He was replaced by Vice President-elect Mike Pence. But then apparently nobody knew that Pence had to sign some papers that Christie had signed in order to get certain information. That doesn't sound like deliberate, you know, power games. It sounds like incompetence.
Well, you know, we'll see which it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's the possibility that, you know, this is a campaign. This was a campaign, frankly, that didn't really prepare for a transition. You know,
right.
There's a group that does transitions that's funded by Congress. They had urged the candidates to get on top of this and have as many as 4,000 appointments, potentially sub-cabinet positions, meted out and thought about during the summer. Well, it doesn't look like the Trump campaign really took that all that seriously.
Now, let's look at the Democratic side, shifting Democratic Party as well. House Democrats delayed their nominating vote until November 30th. Do you see this as a rebuke of Nancy Pelosi, maybe a slap on the wrist, or are they going to try to replace her?
Well, there is a small faction that would like the Democratic Party to go in a different direction. Now, that's easier said than done, because Nancy Pelosi today said she is going to be running for re-election. She also threw a warning shot in there to anybody who wants to run against her and said that she has two-thirds of the support of the caucus locked down. So the likelihood here is that she will win. She will win re-election. She will continue to be the face of the Democratic Party in the House. And part of the reason for that is that she's been able to raise some $500 million, with a B, dollars for her constituents over the many years. She's also a very powerful, strong leader, especially when she was Speaker. She certainly was able to do a far better job than John Boehner, for example, ever did in keeping Democrats aligned. But there are questions on the new direction, if there will be one, of the Democratic Party, given it's the same leaders for a long time.
Well, today, Democratic senators nominated Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, as Senate Minority Leader. How might he work with a Trump administration?
Well, Chuck Schumer, we should note, when we're talking about the new direction of the Democratic Party, also brought Bernie Sanders on board in a kind of new ceremonial position, chair of outreach. So there is the possibility. Chuck Schumer knows that there needs to be some kind of change up and some kind of movement. Remember, Chuck Schumer being from New York, everyone thinks of it as a liberal state. But upstate New York, plenty of counties that had voted for Barack Obama that then switched to vote for Donald Trump. Chuck Schumer is a very smart person. He likes to be in front on message. We will see if he's able to coalesce the Democratic Party on that message and if it will work.
Well, Domenico, one last question. The few seconds we have. Last night, Donald Trump went out to dinner without telling anyone, including some of his assistants and the press. Look, his backers might say, give the guy a break. But why is it important for the press to be there when the president-elect goes somewhere?
Yeah. And look, this is not navel-gazing. The press wants to talk about itself. The fact is that pool reporters following where the president goes, the people need to know where a president is. Think about 9/11. They didn't want a pool following the president around. Reporters said that it would be that right. There would be a million conspiracies if he didn't do it.
We're going to wrap it there.
They brought them on board.
Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
Thank you.
It's here and now. This past weekend, we were transported to 19th century Russia at Broadway's Imperial Theater, which has been transformed into a Russian cabaret in the new glorious musical Natasha and Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812. The show's creator, playwright and composer Dave Malloy, decided to model the stage on a cafe he discovered while traveling in Moscow. Patrons like him sat alongside musicians.
And the entire place was packed with people. Everyone had vodka and dumplings on the table, and everyone had these little shakers on the table, these handmade shakers, and so everyone was shaking along with this music. Yeah, it was during the middle of that evening when I was like, oh, this is the place that Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812 should happen. Like, this is the world that we want to live in.
So we had our shakers. In the audience, we were handed little egg-shaped shakers to play along with orchestra members scattered throughout the house. As the story unfolds, Napoleon's army is on the outskirts of Moscow. In the city, frantic, vodka-soaked, carousing, affairs, angst. It's based on 70 pages of Tolstoy's War and Peace. And we're told at the outset, it gets complicated. Consult your program.
This is on your program. You are at the opera.
You know, when I first read the book, these 70 pages really sang out to me immediately in that there were these kind of these two couples. And a lot of times musicals will have like kind of two romantic couples, like the lead romantic couple and then like the funny couple. And in this show, there was Natasha and Anatole, and they were kind of like the lead sexy romantic couple. And then the other couple was Pierre and God, or Pierre and his existential life crisis. And I loved that kind of subversion of the form.
He also threw out other theater conventions. The actors run up wooden stairs to the balcony. We were part of the audience that was actually sitting at cafe tables on stage, right under star Josh Groban's nose. Here's director Rachel Chavkin.
It just became clear that there was going to be no stage, or that everywhere would be the stage.
Did you worry that those who were not on the stage would either feel distracted by the people on the stage or feel jealous that, wait, I'm not on the stage, looking up Josh Groban's nose?
Well, I think the biggest concern was just maintaining a sense of intimacy for everyone. And so for those people that couldn't be on the stage, we had to, in effect, bring the stage to them.
Light burst into the room, and I saw you rise, and I saw you smile, and the world opened wide.
The show stars Danae Benton as Natasha.
And I catch my breath, and I laugh and blush, and I hear guitars.
And recording star Josh Groban as Pierre, both in their Broadway debuts.
I die in my sleep. They say we are asleep.
Look out.
Hello.
Sorry.
Hi.
Sorry.
Hi. Hey, buddy.
Hi.
After the show, we visited Josh and his ferocious, actually not at all a guard dog, the equally famous to fans, Wheaton Terrier Sweeney.
And who's this?
This is Sweeney.
Hey, Sweeney, you got a little puppy here.
Demon puppy of Fleet Street.
And tried to describe sitting on stage a foot underneath Josh as he performed.
I don't know how to describe that. I actually felt your breath and I could see in your nose.
Yeah, that's I don't know. You either get what you pay for or you want a refund after that. But we certainly get up close and personal with everybody.
I want to talk about that, but just being on stage. Now, you are a superstar. And you have performed for thousands at a time.
Yes.
But what's it like to be in that ensemble?
It's unlike anything I've experienced in my career, and I've done a lot of things. To be a cog in this beautiful wheel and to not have to be a solo, but to be part of a team of so many people, many of which are making their debuts along with me in this show that we all love so much. We can't wait to walk through the stage door and leave our troubles behind us each day.
Just a little bit more on that, because members of the audience are sitting on the stage. I mean, my heart was racing to be surrounded by people exalting, grieving at one point. Mm-hmm. There was an actress sitting, we were knocking knees, yeah, and she was sobbing.
Yeah. Oh, it's incredible. No two shows are the same for us. You know, to have new faces and new spirits in the room that are interacting with us, and that was the X factor that we couldn't wait for, because that educates us as to how we continue our scene, how we do our solos.
There was one moment where there was a kind of a stout man in the front row, uh-huh, who was charged with handing a letter over, and he gave it with a flourish. It was
oh yes, it was like he was called to action, and he's in the show now. His audition paid off. People sometimes don't know how to react when they're asked to be part of it. Sometimes you get a negative feeling, and sometimes you get people that are ready to party.
Talk about your character, Pierre. We understand that you have performed in a play before.
Yes. I was a theater student, and then I got plucked into this world of recorded music, and it's something I've missed so very much. And I haven't donned a beard and gone out and sung theater songs since I was Tevye and at the age of 17. So
Fiddler.
Fiddler. So it's a lifelong dream come true, for sure.
So two things there. There's hope for all the Tevyes in their high school productions.
Oh, yeah.
Right now.
If you're a high school Tevye, I didn't even start as Tevye. I was originally Perchik, and then I worked my way up to Tevye. So even if you're a high school Perchik, you can eventually find yourself on the Broadway boards.
But tell me about Pierre, inhabiting Pierre, a broken man, an alcoholic, slumped shoulders. You're Josh Groban, and things are going pretty well for you. So
yeah, we all have sometimes the questions, the existential questions that Pierre has, especially right now. I think a lot of people are questioning things. And there's a sadness to Pierre that is understandable because of where he is socially. And he knows his wife doesn't love him. Pierre is just full of inner turmoil.
How do you bring him to the stage? One way we know is that you have a little bit of a fat suit on.
Yeah, so I've got a padded suit, which definitely helps with some of the physicality. But other than that, working with Rachel Chavkin, we did a lot of work together to really find Pierre in me. We did movement work. How does he dance? You know, it's not going to be good. How does he fight? How does he go from being this meek, don't mind me, Eeyore kind of thanks for noticing me kind of character to all of a sudden tossing this rogue across his desk?
I was struck when you were singing one of the big numbers. It's the one, I think, was a beautiful line.
Did I squander my divinity? Was happiness within me the whole time? Yeah, Dust and Ashes, great song.
Did I squander my divinity? Was happiness within me the whole time? They say we are asleep until we fall in love. We are children of dark.
I was struck by how there might have been a raised, clenched fist to the sky, or a bitten knuckle, or a hand to the forehead as this character agonized. And you did hardly anything physical.
We did make a conscious decision for much of those kinds of songs to keep it as internal as possible, that if you sing it with honesty and you think it with intensity, that it will come across. And that was a great, very freeing lesson for me.
Look, you're Josh Groban, as it turns out.
Yeah.
Stunning voice.
Thank you.
But you're on Broadway. You know, the Broadway crowd, they sacrifice a lot. Mm-hmm. They don't make a lot. You know, they're like these gypsies in many ways. And yet they're some of the most talented people.
Without question.
Do you ever find yourself thinking, wow?
I say wow all the time, this whole show.
And it's all-
money on women and wine.
He spends his money on women and wine. And so
we left Josh after Sweeney gently gnawed on producer Karen's jacket.
He didn't do any damage to it. I will say, my dog is so funny. He's like a toddler. Notice me, notice me, notice me. He plays with his toy that he didn't care about all day long. He goes and finds him. Maybe I'll just go sniff in the trash.
Surely they've come to interview me. Back in the theater, Natasha and Pierre and the Comet of 1812 creator David Malloy and director Rachel Chavkin look exhausted. It's the weekend before opening night. Well, are you both feeling, David and Rachel, that, you know, perhaps, I mean, I don't know if Josh Groban will attract anyone to Broadway, but that perhaps you have a hit on your hands?
I mean, who knows? We'll find out soon.
Yeah,
enough.
I just keep touching. I touch wood a lot. I'm very superstitious.
They needn't have worried. It opened Monday. The reviews were raves. I prefer it to Hamilton, says the New York Times' Chris Isherwood. But on this visit, before those reviews, David Malloy was thinking about the years that led up to this moment, of how he once played Pierre in small off-Broadway venues. He was also thinking about the Great Comet of 1812, which makes its glorious appearance in the last few moments of the musical, when all seems lost for Natasha, who's fallen, and Pierre, who can't seem to rise.
And their scene at the end is just heartbreaking and heart-shattering. And Pierre's interaction with the Comet afterwards, like, I was just bawling uncontrollably at the end of it. And I still, to this day, can't read that final paragraph without crying. And so I knew I wanted to make a musical of it someday.
And this bright star, having traced its parabola with inexpressible speed through immeasurable.
Yes, great Comet writer and composer Dave Malloy, who here also sings the role of Pierre. This is 4 years ago when his idea of a musical was born in a small off-Broadway theater. He's now replaced himself with Josh Groban. The Imperial Theater is much bigger, and so are the notices. For more on Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812, go to hearnow.org.
President-elect Donald Trump tweeted early today that he is not trying to get top-level security clearance for his children. Rumors that he is have prompted concern in recent days because anti-nepotism laws prevent presidents from appointing family members to formal government jobs. And during his campaign, Trump had said he would put his holdings, his casinos, his hotels under his children's control. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He joins us from New York. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
And there are some pretty big concerns here about conflict of interest.
Yeah, and they would occur in any case with anybody who has a business. Typically, people who go into public office or hold the presidency, they do invest. They're entitled to make money on stuff, but they hold broadly held things like stocks or bonds where their influence wouldn't necessarily directly involve the specific holdings that they have. In the case of Donald Trump's interests, his interests are very specific. A lot of them are subject to regulation or, you know, decisions that he could have an influence over as president. And that's why there are concerns. And by the way, it's not just his hotels. It's, you know, he's got 500 companies all around the world.
Well, give us an example of a conflict that could possibly come up.
Well, you know, he really made a big thing about his new hotel in D.C. Right on, right
on
at the old
Pennsylvania Avenue.
On Pennsylvania Avenue, on the old post office building. That is land owned by the government, leased to Donald Trump's company to run a hotel. So the negotiations for that land take place with the government. The security around that hotel will be handled by the government. If there are union problems, they may involve the National Labor Relations Board. In fact, the National Labor Relations Board just ruled against Donald Trump in one of his Las Vegas properties. So it's sort of tough being on two sides of the deal. And even if it's just his kids, the fact is, it's not somebody removed enough from him to suggest that he doesn't have influence over it or won't have knowledge of decisions being made.
Well, people have talked about a blind trust, which, by the way, is defined by federal law as one in which a federal official selects an independent trustee with no familial ties who sells the official's known assets and purchases investments unknown to the official. That's what makes it blind. Any chance of that?
He hasn't indicated that there's any chance of that. It's also a little bit more problematic, even though that's the strictest definition of a blind trust. Even that may is problematic in Donald Trump's instance, because he has things that are licensed that aren't his, but that his name is on. And those are contracts that go on for a long time. So he has his name on buildings, on products and things like that, where even selling it would still cause the Trump name to be associated. So it's yet one step more complicated than the already strict guidelines that the federal government recommends.
Does he legally have to do anything as president of the United States?
Well, it's unclear that he has to do anything just because he's president of the United States. Where this becomes an issue is the very first time something happens that involves a business interest of his, whether it's a negotiation at a hotel or a federal ruling on one of his hotels. So this is why it becomes messy, because you don't want to be dealing with it in the moment where somebody gets a court order to say, not only am I suing Donald Trump, but Donald Trump's now the president of the United States, so now I'm up against that, and it could get very complicated. So it would be better that they all figure it out now.
That's Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
The Vietnam War ended over 40 years ago. Now, we know it continues for many veterans in emotional and physical struggles, but now there is a new one. Some veterans are just now developing a rare cancer related to their time overseas, but many are finding themselves fighting the VA for benefits as well as the cancer. Robin McDowell is an investigative reporter for the Associated Press. She joins us from the AP newsroom in Minneapolis. Hi, Robin.
Thank you.
This rare cancer, cholangiocarcinoma, bile duct cancer, can be caused by parasites in river fish. They're called liver flukes. Tell us more about that.
Yes, these are parasites that are in some river fish all across Southeast Asia, but most of the studies have been in Thailand, but they are also known to be present in Vietnam. Some villages have about 30% of the population have eaten fish and are infected by these liver flukes.
Because why? How do they ultimately cause cancer?
Well, what happens is they attach themselves to the lining of the bile duct, and they basically lie there dormant for decades. Up to 25 years, they can live inside the liver. And then what happens is they start kind of forming scars on the lining, and that becomes infected. And then over time, that turns into this really brutal form of cancer.
Which is why some veterans who might have fought in Vietnam 40 or more years ago are just now developing this cancer.
Exactly. And the problem is they don't know they have it. They don't have any symptoms until the final stages. So once the symptoms start to develop, that's things like jaundice, itchy skin. By then, they're told they just have a few months left to live.
Oh, terrible. And their private doctors, in many cases, firmly believe that this is liver fluke, that it's linked to these Vietnamese river fish. And you spoke to a man who talked about living on the river fish when he was in Vietnam.
Yes, I think most of the men actually had army rations, but what would happen is they'd go into the battlefield and they wouldn't have any alternative but to eat the fish. And the big problem is when it's poorly cooked or raw, and they were basically using what amounted to Bunsen burners, sometimes cooking them in their helmets. But then it's also a popular food for the locals, for the Vietnamese. So when they would go into villages, they would be offered food, and they were really encouraged to accept it. There's actually even a booklet that they were given before they arrived in Vietnam that talked about, you know, enjoy the local cuisine, including this fish, which and a special fish paste, which is exactly what this fish is made out of, and it's not cooked. It's a fermented fish. So they had no idea.
No. But did anyone, in other words, did the military, did people know about this parasite 40, 50 years ago?
I honestly think the U.S. military did not know up until recently. It is very common in Southeast Asia, as I said. So most of the studies and the research have been done there, most extensively in northern Thailand.
Yeah. Well, so here we come to the point in the story where these veterans have this cancer. And their doctors, their private doctors, believe, as we said, it's linked to this fish. But they go to the VA for benefits. And what does the VA say?
Well, basically, it's happening on a case-by-case basis. So this is a very rare form of cancer in the United States. Even private doctors hardly see it. Many of the patients that they get are Asian immigrants who brought it with them. So it really depends on the doctor they've gone to see. And the same is true with the VA doctors. When they go to regional VA offices, they might not recognize it. And it really ends up often being the soldier or the veteran who has to make the link. You know, they go online, they see the research out of Asia, they see Facebook page discussion groups that other vets experiencing the same thing.
Well, so we understand from your reporting the VA has now seen around 700 cases of this bile duct cancer in the last 15 years or so. And some of them are getting benefits, some aren't. It seems kind of haphazard.
That's exactly the problem. Some of the veterans or their widows, nowadays it's more often widows than the veterans in the last few years, they will provide the exact same information. They will get the letter from their private doctor, and they will sometimes compile their own reams of research showing this liver fluke and the problems elsewhere. And they hand it in, and then it just pretty much depends on who sees the case, which doctor or judge, and they stamp it approval or deny. More often deny. And eventually, after, you know, 3 or 4 rounds of appeals, which can take up to 10 years, they might get it approved. But it's not a fight that any of them want to be fighting.
No. Well, especially since, as one of the vets you quote says, I dodged all those bullets, then get killed by a fish.
Exactly.
What else did the veteran say to you?
Well, a lot of these men, I mean, what they want more than, they were loyal soldiers. They actually talk fondly about their, you know, their ability to serve the country. What they feel most upset about is that it's not being recognized now, that they are dying as well, and that it's just, you know, they're left to fend for themselves.
No. And what is the VA saying? Because you quote VA officials in some cases as saying it's as likely as not that the cancer is connected to the veteran's time in Vietnam. And yet, even saying that it's as likely as not, the benefits are denied. So what is the VA saying?
Yes, well, just to explain the as likely or not, Congress wrote a law for the very reason that no doctor can possibly know, and also because no service member can possibly know everything that they're exposed to during their active duty service. So all they have to show is that there's a 50-50 chance that they got it. The benefit of the doubt by law goes to the veteran.
And this is after previous veterans' fights over things like the effect of Agent Orange.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the VA, I mean, I when we spoke to the VA, my sense was really that they're not maliciously trying to deny benefits to these men. It would not cost them a lot of money. There's not a lot of them. But they really seem to not understand what was happening. They said that there's 700 men who have gone through the system in the last 15 years, but they didn't think that there had been any significant increase. And so it took us filing a Freedom of Information Act request to see what the numbers actually were. And they had been going up significantly in the last 15 years. It had increased sixfold. So I think they were not aware. And when we talked to them, they said, you know, we're curious to see what you find out about this, because it's kind of something that they have not been monitoring. What really would be beneficial is if they started by putting the word out to the regional VA offices that this exists, that men who visit them with these symptoms should be told that they might have been exposed in Vietnam and that they might be entitled to benefits. None of that is happening.
Well, maybe it will now. Robin McDowell, investigative reporter for the Associated Press, will link you to her reporting at hereandnow.org. Robin, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
And staying with veterans, the head of the National Museum of the Great Lakes is on a quest. He's trying to locate Navy pilots who trained on Lake Michigan during World War II, a little-known chapter of that lake's history. Elizabeth Miller from WCPN IdeaStream has the story.
Between 1942 and 1945, 17,000 pilots landed planes on the USS Wolverine and USS Sable, two makeshift aircraft carriers stationed on Lake Michigan. It was part of their training for the war in the Pacific with Japan. Among the pilots, former President George H.W. Bush. A new documentary called Heroes on Deck details that training mission. Heroes on Deck features home videos captured by one of the pilots, as well as video from the National Archives. In the film, author Beverly Dawson recounts the danger pilots and deck officers faced during training.
A lot of the deckhands were at risk if the arresting wires came loose and strike someone. There were fires. Sometimes the deckhands would walk into an engine. That could be fatal.
And it was. According to the Naval History Museum, 8 pilots were killed during the training.
It's the story of the operation of these aircraft carriers and what remains of their activities, which are essentially plane wrecks.
That's Christopher Gilchrist, executive director of the National Museum of the Great Lakes. He says over 100 plane wrecks occurred on Lake Michigan during training. Heroes on Deck is making its way to Cleveland, and Gilchrist is looking for pilots who trained on Lake Michigan. He wants them to be a part of a showing next month in Cleveland and document their experience.
They're able to relate stories that help illuminate what happened in that experience. You know, perhaps one of the pilots had a crash landing. Perhaps he knew one of the other officers on one of the aircraft carriers and leads us to that person.
Gilchrist estimates that about 2,000 World War II pilots who trained on Lake Michigan are still alive. Fewer than 10 maybe in Northeast Ohio. If you know of any, let us know. For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Miller in Cleveland.
Retiring Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer wants to abolish the Electoral College. She filed legislation yesterday calling for an amendment to the Constitution that would end the system. It's a call that is getting a lot of support from Democrats as it becomes more certain that Hillary Clinton will win the popular vote. She's leading now by about 1 million votes with the final count to come. Andrew Rudalevich is a professor of government at Bowdoin College. He joins us from Portland, Maine. Welcome.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And this bill from Senator Boxer has almost no chance of making its way through the Republican House and Senate and past the president's desk, but it makes a statement. How long have people been trying to get rid of the Electoral College?
Well, from pretty early on. I mean, there have been more than 700 resolutions introduced in Congress to try to change it or straight out repeal it. And so this joins a long line of attempts to shift the way that our presidents are chosen.
What are the problems with the system right now?
Well, I mean, the most basic problem is that, you know, different people's votes count unequally. And so if you start from the premise that one person, one vote is the only legitimate way to select the only legitimate winner, then you do have, you know, a pretty strong problem of democratic theory here. The person who gets the most votes can lose.
It's also bad for third parties, I've read.
Well, it is, because the winner-take-all nature of the system, as in any sort of first-past-the-post system, tends to you know, reduce your choices to two, right? Any other choice is a wasted vote. And so, you know, going back to 2000, a vote for Nader is a vote for Bush sort of thing. And people were talking about that this year with regards to, you know, Governor Johnson and Dr. Stein.
On the other hand, people who are in favor of the Electoral College would say this is the reason that candidates have to pay attention to states that may not have huge populations but are very important nonetheless.
Right. I mean, the basic idea, right, is that the American republic rather than democracy, you know, it's a democratic republic. It's a representative democracy that seeks to build consensus across very many different coalitions. And you see lots of structures in the Constitution that protect the rights of minorities. And so the Electoral College, even though, you know, if we go back to the Constitutional Convention, it's certainly a compromise, right? It's not a random compromise. It's one that fits into a federal system of separated and checks powers that has some nervousness about majorities and the wisdom of crowds.
Now, you write that the framers of the Constitution hoped the electors would be independent, well-informed about national policy and potential leaders. That is not part of the criteria today, right? The people that actually become the electors don't have to do those things.
Right. You could argue that today, in fact, having independent judgment is disqualifying to become an elector. Because of the way that states have tried to bind electors to the results of the popular vote in their state.
Well, what about the petitions that are out there to try to get electors right now to change the vote that they were going to cast and instead cast it for the winner of the popular vote?
Well, I mean, electors, despite state laws that bind them to the state popular vote, do have the potential to become what are sometimes called faithless electors. That is to say, to vote for somebody who did not win the popular vote in that state.
And that has that ever happened?
It does happen occasionally. It's never changed the outcome of the election. There was someone who basically abstained in 2000, somebody who voted for John Edwards instead of John Kerry for president in 2004. So there are state laws in a number of states that try to bind electors to the popular vote. And the Supreme Court has held that that is constitutional to try, but they've never been enforced. Nobody's ever been prosecuted. And, you know, it would be after the fact in any case.
Do you see any chance of any kind of reform of the Electoral College system?
Well, the most popular proposal that's out there right now is called the National Popular Vote Compact. And basically each of the states in that compact promises that whoever wins the national popular vote, it will select electors who will vote for that winner rather than the person who won.
But aren't all the states that have signed on to that blue states at this point?
They are at this point. So it'll be, you know, and even there, this does run the risk. Well, two risks maybe that people were, you know, concerned with changing the Electoral College point out. One is, of course, this faithless elector problem. The other, of course, is that plurality elections have their own issues. One reason that some political theorists like the two-party system, even though it does you know, quite overtly limit voter choice, is that it provides stability. And it provides, you know, again, at least in theory, the push of the candidates towards the median voter, towards moderation and towards the middle. So if you had a system where, you know, you could win in a, say, a five-person field with 21, 22, 25% of the vote, you know, is it okay if somebody wins with 25%? Should we have a runoff election? You know, Maine just adopted a ranked choice voting proposal for state elections. Is that something that would be worked in? So there are other questions that are raised by the reforms. And, you know, some people are nervous that those possibly unintended consequences have not been discussed enough.
And could be worse than the current system.
Well, certainly for some, yeah.
That's Andrew Rudalevich, who's a professor of government at Bowdoin College. Andrew, thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Robin Young. This is Here and Now.